Good evening. Thanks for coming out. Merry Christmas. Well, we're looking at one verse tonight, Luke chapter 2, verse 7. Just one verse. 50 minutes on one verse. I really appreciate this church and its long and faithful witness in this community and in this region and in this world. It's so important to have healthy, thriving, growing churches, and I am grateful to God for the way that His Holy Spirit is active in this church, for the way that His Son is able to manifest Himself through this church, for the way that God is glorified through this church. So thank you for the way that you're present in the world and for the way that God is able to work through you and in you. And I just encourage you to keep it up. It is so absolutely critical to have strong spiritual communities in this world, places of light and love. So continue that good work. Let's go to this next slide. Back in 2015, there were several of us from Highland who flew to Beijing, China, and we stood in the Forbidden City, stood right there on these ancient stones in the Forbidden City. Next slide. The Forbidden City is literally the heart of Beijing, and for centuries, it was the geographical, it was the spiritual, it was the economical, it was the political heart of this critical city in China. Next slide. It was built as the home of the emperors in China, and it was called the Forbidden City, basically because unless you were unusually high up in society in China, you were forbidden from entering this special city at the heart of Beijing. Next slide. This Forbidden City had 9,999.5 rooms, which in ancient Chinese thinking was one half room shy of heaven. In their ancient way of thinking, heaven had 10,000 rooms. And so the emperor had this city at the heart of Beijing, which had 9,999.5 rooms. So he lived just half a room shy of heaven, as close as you could get to heaven. Could you imagine having a city with that many rooms? 9,999.5 rooms. Next slide. Now, that picture may be familiar to you. You see this picture all over the place. It shows up in advertisements and marketing slides all over. I touched this statue sitting there in the Forbidden City. It shows this ferocious-looking lion with his paw resting on this round object. So who can guess what the lion represents in the Forbidden City? The emperor, right? And what does the round object upon which his paw rests represent? The world. And so what is that telling us? He's got the whole world in his hands, right? The emperor has the world in his hands. He is the ruler of the world, and he's living half a room shy of heaven. He's a pretty important guy living here in the Forbidden City. Next slide. So the Forbidden City is a really important place because it reveals the posture that the emperors of China took toward the entire world around them. And the posture that the emperors took toward the world around them was a protective stance that created isolation from the world. A protective stance that created isolation between them and the world around them. Now, fortunately, that never happens today in the Christian world, right? The church has never taken a protective stance that creates isolation between it and the world around them. And I'm sure that none of us as individual followers of Jesus have ever created distance between ourselves and our neighborhoods or our workplaces or our schools. So there's nothing at all to learn here from these ancient Chinese emperors. Next slide. Now, nothing symbolized this more than this massive wall that runs all the way around the Forbidden City. Next slide. There was no way to really scale over that wall. It was just too tall to jump over or to try to climb over. Next slide. Speeding through this wall was really unimaginable. Every so often, if you walked around this whole wall around the city, there were these gateways, and they would have been heavily armed by soldiers. And so if you just tried to speed through one of these gateways, they would have just killed you right there on the spot. No way to get through one of those gateways. And then next slide. If you tried to, pull a Bugs Bunny or something and dig under the wall and come up the other side, there were these stones that covered the floor of the Forbidden City that we were told by our guide were about 15 feet deep. So even if you dug under the wall and tried to come up under the other side, you'd bang your head and your shovel up against 15 feet deep of these stones. So no way to get through. Next slide. Even if you were able to get over the wall or through the wall or under the wall to try to get to the emperor, it still would have been a very difficult task. They of course, understood that most attacks on the emperor would take place at night. And so the emperor had 9 bedrooms, and each of those bedrooms had 3 beds in them, and he switched beds every single night. So even if you managed to get over, under, or through that wall, you had to guess which bed the emperor was sleeping in that night, which bedroom he was in, and which of the 3 beds in that bedroom he was sleeping in that night. So next slide here. So the emperor, through all of that, he chose a protective stance against the world that created as much isolation as possible between him and the world around him. So contrast that, then, with the posture that Jesus took toward the world. Jesus chose a perilous rather than protective stance, a stance that led to intimacy rather than isolation. Two extremely different postures to the world around us. So I want to look at Jesus' posture toward the world, especially as we see it in the birth narrative, and reflect on how that might inform the way that we act in our world, whether it's our workplace, our neighborhood, our school, and the posture that this church as a whole takes toward the world and the community around it. Next slide. So even though Jesus actually lived in heaven, he didn't just have 9,999 and 1/2 rooms. He actually had all 10,000 rooms. He actually lived in heaven, and yet he didn't choose a protective stance that kept him isolated from our world. He became intimate with our world. And even though he actually did hold the world in his hands, he didn't just have a little statue that symbolized his rule over the world. Jesus, He created the world in the first place, and then he holds the world in his hands. And yet he didn't remain distant from the world. He drew near to the world. Next slide. And he didn't just give us the Forbidden City. In essence, what Jesus came to do is create sort of an unforbidden city where there is no wall and all people are invited to come to him. Or rather, he draws near to as many people who will have him. Next slide. So there's no better place to see this at work than in Luke chapter 2, verse 7, just this one verse where Luke tells us so much about the way in which Jesus draws near to the world and how we might draw near to the world as well. So Luke chapter 2, verse 7, notice these three phrases in bold. And she gave birth to her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloths, and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. Next slide. So in these three phrases, just those three short phrases in Luke 2, verse 7, Luke draws our attention to three perils that Jesus faced in order to draw near to us. Rather than protecting himself from the world around us, Jesus faced three perils to draw near to us, to create intimacy with the world around us. And these are three perils that we should consider facing as a church and as individuals. So she gave birth to her firstborn son. Jesus endured hazardousness. She wrapped him in swaddling cloths. He endured helplessness. And she laid him in a manger because there was no space for them in the inn. He endured homelessness. So let's just look at each one of those three and reflect on what that might mean for us to endure those same three perils. Next slide. So first, Jesus endured hazardousness. In choosing to be born, in choosing childbirth, in choosing childhood, Jesus chose a very hazardous way to draw near to the world around him. Next slide. So let's think about this for just a moment. So Jesus is in heaven, and here we are on the earth. So let's think about this in terms of skiing. How many here have ever snow skied? So a few. How many have ever water skied? So a lot more have water skied. Okay, so when you snow ski, if you're at the top of the mountain and you want to get down to the bottom of the mountain, when I used to snow ski in New Mexico, that's where I grew up, was New Mexico. And when I used to go snow skiing in New Mexico, my mom would not ski with us. She would stay in the lodge down at the bottom of the mountain. And so I'd go to the top of the mountain. If I wanted to close the distance between where I was and where my mom was, basically I had three choices. And most skiers have three choices if they want to get from the top down to the bottom, close that distance. You've got green circle paths. And what are green circle paths at a ski area? They're the easy ones, right? Big wide trails, and no moguls, and they're not very steep, right? And or you could take the blue square trails. What are those like? They're kind of so-so, right? They're a little narrower, and maybe a few bumps, maybe a little steeper. Or you could take the black diamond trails, right? No. What are the black diamond trails like? Real hard. They're like that, right? Almost perpendicular. Tons of moguls, really narrow, really tough, really, really difficult trails. Next slide. So when Jesus decided to close the gap between heaven and earth and become intimate with the world, become intimate with the human race, there are really three paths that he could have chosen. He could have chosen a green circle kind of path, and he could have just decided to move in among us as a spirit. No flesh and blood, you know, let's not mess with that. That's just hard, you know, all that flesh and blood kind of stuff. He could have just been a spirit and come and taught and done some really neat stuff among us as a spirit. Green circle kind of path. Next slide. He could have chosen the blue square kind of path and come as flesh and blood, but maybe just come as an adult. No teenager stuff to go through, no childhood stuff to go through. Just come in as an adult, fully grown adult, and do all that good stuff. Next slide. But instead, what Jesus chose to do was the black diamond path. He came not just as flesh and blood, but he came through childbirth. She gave birth to her firstborn son, Luke tells us. Jesus chose to be born, which is an extremely hazardous path to gain intimacy with the human race. Next slide. I mean, just think about your own experience with childbirth and childhood. Next slide here. Raise your hand. Just think about your own childbirth and childhood. Raise your hand if you had complications with your own birth, or if as a child you ever suffered a broken bone, or if as a child you ever suffered a significant disease, you know, measles or something like that as a child, or as a child if you had a significant accident, you know, on your skateboard or your bicycle or something like that. I mean, how many of you had some difficult experience, childbirth or childhood? All right, several of us have. Or okay, next slide here. Think about yourself as a parent or a grandparent. How many of you have ever had children or grandchildren who had complications at birth or significant disease as a child, or they had an accident as a child, or you know, had difficulties? Your children or grandchildren had difficulties even more hands going up. So even today, right, childbirth, childhood is pretty tough. Next slide. This is where you get to feel sorry for me. So I almost didn't make it through childbirth. I'm a twin. My twin Craig and I, we were born 6 weeks early. This is a picture of beautiful me. I know it's hard to make out. They didn't have iPhones back then. So I was 3 pounds, 10 ounces. My brother was 4 pounds, 12 ounces. So you can see who was hogging the womb there. And I had to stay in neonatal intensive care for 4 weeks. Craig was in neonatal intensive care for 2 weeks. So even in my own experience, childbirth was extremely hazardous. Next slide. Shelby County, Tennessee, which is where I'm from. In 2013, we had 15 baby deaths per 1,000 live births. It was the worst infant mortality rate in the United States, similar to French Guiana, Kuwait, Lithuania. It's still hard to be a child. Childbirth, childhood is still hazardous. Next slide. Thankfully, in Memphis, Shelby County, that rate dropped. Next slide. In 2014, several zip codes in Memphis had an infant mortality rate that was 3 times the national average. Next slide. CDC says that 23,000 infants died in the U.S. in 2013. Next slide. U.S. News and World Report says there are 1 million miscarriages every year in the United States. Next slide. World Health Organization says in 2015, 4.5 million infants died before their first birthday. Childbirth, childhood is hazardous. Next slide. Even more so in Jesus' day. One scholar of ancient Israel says about 30% of children born in ancient Israel didn't reach maturity. Next slide. In terms of ancient Rome, the infant mortality rate was between 25 and 35%. And then, next slide. In terms of the ancient world in general, some of the poorest areas had as many as 50% of children didn't reach maturity. And yet Jesus chose that path of childbirth and childhood, this extremely hazardous path to draw near to us, to create intimacy with the human race. Next slide. So why did he do that? Why did he do that? Well, number one, I think so that he could sympathize with us. So that he could sympathize with us in our own experiences with hazards in life and hurts in life. Obviously, Jesus made it through his childbirth and childhood, right? But he chose the perils of childbirth and childhood in part, I think, because he wanted to be able to sympathize with the human race. Our lives are filled with hazards and the potential for pain and for hurt. And so by entering our lives in that way, Jesus is able to sympathize with us. I don't want to linger there. I just want to mention that. Next slide. Here's where I want to stop. I think more importantly, the reason that Jesus chose this path of childhood and childbirth is that he wanted to encourage us, his church, his followers, to do the same. That is, because we follow a Savior who endured hazards to draw near to us, he wants a church that's willing to do the same thing. He wants a church, a people, who are willing to endure hazards to draw near to others as well. Next slide. In other words, I think Jesus wants us to be a birthing community. And by that I mean a community willing to endure hazards, perils, dangers, in order to draw near to the people around us. Jesus wants a people willing to endure discomfort in order to draw near to people in our neighborhoods, our workplaces, our schools. Next slide. One example of this, Gregory Boyle. Let me read this story to you. In the 1990s, there were over 90,000 gang members in Los Angeles. Nearly 2,000 people were dying each year, many of them from gang-related violence. Law enforcement agencies struggled to contain the violence, much less change the hearts of those committing it. Enter Gregory Boyle, a Jesuit priest. He decided that the Christian faith had something to offer these gang members, that compassion could overcome aggression. He started a program that became known as Homeboy Industries. It provides job skills training and employment opportunities for former gang members. He raises $10 million each year to keep the program afloat. It's dangerous, messy work. He's buried 200 young adults over the years who died from gang-related violence. The office is often the target of attacks, even bomb threats. But he, his congregation, and others continue to draw near to gangs in spite of the hazards, because that's what Jesus did. In one interview, he recalled how things came to a head one night at the parish he preached for, the poorest parish in Los Angeles at the time. He and other church members had been reaching out to gang members, trying to get them to leave their lives of drugs and violence. Now gang members were hanging out at the small church building, smoking together in small groups, lifting weights in a church garage, taking classes because they've been kicked out of schools. And he tells it this way. This didn't thrill all parishioners, and the grumbling reached a pitch that forced me to call a parish meeting. The parish hall was packed. This would either be a vote of confidence in my leadership or an opportunity for the parishioners to tell me, here's your hat, what's your hurry? I didn't speak, but the E.F. Huttons of the community, when they spoke, people tended to listen. Teresa Navarro and Paula Hernandez needed only to stand and invoke Jesus. We help gang members at this parish because it is what Jesus would do. People applauded, and the parish never looked back. So one example of a church and followers of Jesus that endured some discomfort, some inconvenience, even danger, to draw near to these people that were living around their church building. What does that mean for you? What would it mean for this church to be a birthing community, to endure any peril, any hazard, to draw near to the people around it? Next slide. So Jesus not only endured hazardousness, but helplessness. She not only gave birth to her firstborn, but she wrapped him in swaddling cloths. Wrapped him in swaddling cloths. Next slide. Just as in the first century, so in the 21st century, there's hardly any creature more helpless than an infant. And those of us who've spent any time around any infant understand that, right? I mean, infants can't do anything for themselves. Every need has to be provided for them. Next slide. And Luke is highlighting the helplessness of even Jesus by drawing our attention to this one fact that he was swaddled. He was swaddled. And swaddling is just the wrapping of strips of cloth or linen tightly around an infant. Next slide. We don't always see the infant Jesus depicted as swaddled in paintings or other depictions. One of the more famous paintings that shows Jesus actually swaddled is this one from Italy by a painter named Giotto. And you see Jesus here. It kind of looks like a mummy, right? Strips of cloth or linen wrapped around Jesus. This is swaddling. This is what they would do in the ancient world for a helpless infant. Next slide. Many of our contemporary nativity scenes don't show this. Next slide. The nativity scene that we show, that we have in our house that we take out each Christmas, the little infant Jesus looks like this one here. And you know, where he's got a full head of hair, first of all. A little strip there covering his privates. And then his arms are just kind of outstretched, like he's saying, you know, whatever you're dealing with, just bring it to me, because I can handle it. Even though I'm a baby, I can handle it. But the picture that Luke is giving us is just the opposite. He's saying even Jesus was so helpless that he had to be swaddled. Next slide. Those bands wrapped around the infant would essentially simulate the womb, because the baby couldn't warm himself or comfort himself. The cloths of swaddling would warm and comfort the infant. So babies were swaddled in the ancient world and even still today in many cultures, simply because they were helpless. It's a sign, a symbol of their helplessness. Next slide. It's such a common cultural symbol of helplessness in the ancient world that God would use it to describe his constant help. In Job 38, we read this: "Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed." As God describes the helplessness of creation and how creation needs God to care for it, he uses this image of swaddling here. Or next slide. In Ezekiel 16, God talks about the helplessness of his own people, and swaddling comes up. "As for your birth, on the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling cloths." You know, part of the imagery that God uses here to describe the utter helplessness and need of his own people was the lack of swaddling in this imagery. Next slide. So Jesus enters our world here, Luke is saying, as a helpless infant in need of swaddling. Next slide. And so the question is, why? You know, why choose that way of drawing near to us? Again, number one, I think so that he might sympathize with us. In those times in our lives when we feel helpless, when we're willing to admit our own helplessness, we have a Savior who knows what that's like. He was so helpless that he had to be swaddled. And so he can sympathize and empathize with us in that. And what good news that is for us to proclaim to the world around us, filled with so many people living in states of helplessness. We don't have a Savior who is so protected and isolated that he's never known helplessness. Instead, we proclaim a Savior who has lived helpless. And so he knows what it is like. And what good news that is to the world around us. Next slide. And next slide. And next slide. And next slide. There we go. But I think more importantly, and here's where I want to press in. Jesus chose this path because he wants a church, a group of followers who will embrace those who are similarly helpless. He wants his church to become a community who swaddles the helpless. Next slide. So we're not only called to become a birthing community, we're called to become a swaddling community. If we want to become good news in the world today, we're not only called to become a birthing community, we're called to become a swaddling community. A community where people who are helpless could come without having to fix everything in their life first. And our first response to them would simply be to swaddle them, to care for them, to wrap them tightly in love and compassion. That's what it would be to be a swaddling community. Next slide. So the church becomes good news when it is transformed from just another place for those who have it all together to the one place for those who are falling apart. And, you know, too often, whether it is intentional or not, the message that some churches communicate is that if you want to belong here, you first got to fix yourself up. And when the broken and helpless show up, we're not really sure what to do with them. And we'd rather them, I don't know, get all that worked out before they show up. But if Luke 2, verse 7 has anything to inform our posture to the world around us, it would be to say, hey, we're a community, not for everybody who has it all worked out, but we're a community for people who are falling apart. We're a swaddling community. If you're helpless, you belong here because we will swaddle you. That's what we're here for. Next slide. This is a challenging quote here from Rachel Held Evans in her book, Searching for Sunday. She says, I get a lot of emails from people who fit right into the church until the divorce, the diagnosis, the miscarriage, the depression. And what they find is when they bring their pain or their doubt or their uncomfortable truth to church, someone immediately grabs it out of their hands to try and fix it, to try and make it go away. Convinced the gospel is a product we've got to sell to an increasingly shrinking market, we like our people to function as walking advertisements. Happy, put together, finished, proof that this Jesus stuff works. Next slide. The world is watching, Christians like to say, so let's be on our best behavior and quickly hide the mess. Let's throw up some before and after shots and roll that flashy footage of our miracle product, blanching out every sign of dirt, hiding every sign of disease. But if the world is watching, we might as well tell the truth. And the truth is, the church doesn't offer a cure. It doesn't offer a quick fix. The church offers the messy, inconvenient, gut-wrenching, never-ending work of healing and reconciliation. The church offers grace. Anything else we try to peddle is snake oil. Or we might say what the church offers is swaddling. So that when people come to us with addictions and divorce and depression and problems, we don't try to sweep it under the rug. We don't demand a quick fix. What we do is we swaddle. We wrap people up tightly with love and compassion. We become a community for the helpless. Next slide. Next slide. And then finally, Jesus chose the path of homelessness. Homelessness. So this third phrase in Luke 2, verse 7, she laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. Next slide. When our daughter Jordan was born, we loaded her up in the minivan, took her home, put her in the nursery in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Next slide. When our son Jacob was born, we loaded him up in the minivan, put him in the nursery in our home in Bartlett, Tennessee. But when Jesus was born, Joseph didn't pull up the minivan in the circle drive of the hospital, and did not take Jesus and Mary to the freshly painted nursery back home, right? Jesus laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. First of all, they weren't even home. And second, all they had was a manger. Next slide. Probably more like this than what we often see depicted. Probably more of a stone feeding trough. And not necessarily in a barn. It may have been more of a cave-like structure there. And certainly not in a property that they owned. Jesus was born into temporary homelessness. He eventually got to go home on a donkey. But he was born into homelessness. He chose to be born into temporary homelessness. Next slide. Why? Again, one, I think to sympathize with us in our various stages of homelessness. There's all kinds of homelessness. And I think Jesus chose to be born into this temporary homelessness so that he could sympathize with people all over the world who live in various stages of homelessness. Next slide. Here in this country, actual physical, literal homelessness is counted on one night each year. And so in January 2014, the night that it was counted, 500,000 people in the United States were experiencing homelessness, sleeping outside or in emergency shelter, transitional housing. 500,000 people. In Tennessee, it was 9,000 people. In Memphis, it was 1,600 people. Next slide. And so even with physical homelessness, Jesus sympathizes with that. But I think more importantly, he chose that path so that he might create a group of people who could empathize and sympathize with that and then provide a home for the homeless as well. So we're called to be a manger community because of Luke 2, verse 7. called to be a birthing community, swaddling community, but a manger community as well, a community that provides a home for the homeless. Next slide here. And again, there are all kinds of homeless situations that people find themselves in. I know there, as Jim and I were having dinner together, there are a number of international students here in the community. And they're experiencing a kind of homelessness. And they have a place where they're laying their head down each night, but they're so far removed from home. And so in the ministry that you're providing for them, what you're doing is you're providing a home for them. You're becoming a manger community for them. We started a church in Bielotsirkva, Ukraine, and then this conflict in Syria erupted, and of course Russia made some powerful moves of their own. And so a stream of refugees came into Ukraine, and this little church in Bielotsirkva has had the opportunity to host a number of refugees now in Bielotsirkva, Ukraine, and they've with no strategic plan have now been called to become a manger community. In Memphis, one of the larger portions of our homeless population is homeless pregnant women. And up until a few years ago, there were no formal ministries or social service agencies helping that population. And so we worked with some others to start Families in Transition, which serves homeless pregnant women and helps them find housing for 2 years and gives them job skills training and other services over a period of time, trying to be a manger community in that way. Timothy Hill Children's Ranch is a partner of ours, and they saw this growing need in the foster care community, whereas young men and young women were aging out of the foster care community. Many of them weren't quite prepared yet to live on their own and were becoming homeless. And so they've stepped in now to provide greater job skills training and housing and residences for young men and young women who are aging out of the foster care, becoming a manger community there. Next slide. So, you know, what would it be for you as an individual, for this group as a church, to become even more of a manger community? Going back to Beijing here. So these Chinese emperors creating a posture of protection, creating isolation from the world around them. There's a fancy word for that, and that word is excarnation. Excarnation, which basically just means to not be fully present in the world, to not be bodily present in the world, but to be distant from the world around you. Excarnation. And there are ways in which churches practice excarnation, in which Christians practice excarnation, in which, you know, we may have a building in the midst of a community. We may live in the midst of a community, but we're not fully present in a community or in the lives of people. What Jesus practiced, next slide, is the opposite of that, and it's called incarnation. And essentially what incarnation means is to be fully present in the midst of the world, to be bodily present, fully present in the midst of the world. And what Luke 2, verse 7, next slide, gives us are three ways in which Jesus did that, and three ways in which we might be challenged to do that, to become a birthing community, willing to endure any hazard to draw near to the people around us, to be a swaddling community, willing to embrace those who are experiencing helplessness, and to become a manger community, willing to provide a home, in whatever sense that means, to those who are experiencing homelessness. So that's one way, one of many different ways in which Jesus became good news to the world around him. And that's one way in which we become good news in the world today. I'm really grateful for your attention here tonight. I'm grateful for the way that you already are good news in the world, and I hope that you're encouraged to continue being good news.